those things. So when one thing changes, another thing changes.
The gross national product does not allow the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play.
This is what we're seeing around the world. Virtually everyone who's in power has read and swallowed an economics textbook to some extent, and they accept the superficial, simplified stuff they learn in first year. And then they're advised by people who've done PhDs, and they think that they know the complexities. But the ones who do the PhDs are ones who never had the revelation that I had and just think the theory is all sound. So you end up with people in politics imposing neoclassical ideas as what they think is advanced economics, and they're supported by people who claim to be experts, but unlike me, they haven't been exposed to the rotten underbelly, and they end up defending the theory when they should be rejecting it.
Hello and welcome to Invisible Handcuffs, a podcast that seeks to expose the economic ideology underpinning our crises and explore ways we can free ourselves from its chains. My name is Katie Shields, and I'm a recovering mainstream economist and your host. My guest this week is Steve Keen. Steve is a prolific writer, teacher, blogger and vlogger, known as one of few economists to have predicted the 2007 financial crash and a thorn in the side of mainstream economists for over 50 years. A former professor at the University of Kingston in the UK, today you're most likely to find Steve on YouTube or one of his weekly online courses talking about the crisis of capitalism, as well as the new real-world economics that Steve is trying to build. We had this discussion just after Steve's 73rd birthday and in the same week that he appeared on The Diary of a CEO, an episode that has so far garnered almost 8 million views. So I was delighted he accepted my invite to this, at least for now, more modest project. I first came across Steve's work when I was researching why the world had ignored the 1972 study, The Limits to Growth. Steve had uncovered deep flaws in climate economics, the strand of mainstream economics used by governments around the world to inform climate policies, set carbon prices and spending priorities. The godfather of climate economics, William Nordhaus, was also one of the core critics of the limits to growth. But while that study had warned of a civilizational collapse this century, a trajectory we appear to be on track for, Nordhaus's own model effectively predicted the exact opposite. And yet it would be his model that would set the template for climate economics, with Steve and I agreeing that this is one of the core reasons that we've had decades of ongoing delay in tackling our crises. And we talk about why economists in particular prefer that story, the one that capitalism will always save us, and particularly technology will always save us, even as they continue to exclude energy and feedback loops from environmental degradation into their models. We also discuss what led Steve to reject mainstream economics, with Steve explaining, similar to John Harvey in episode 2, that it was an encounter with a non-mainstream teacher that led him down a rabbit hole to uncovering more and more flaws in mainstream thinking. There's a phrase about mainstream economics, and I don't know who it is attributed to, but it goes, you have to be smart enough to understand it, but dumb enough to believe it. Steve is one of few economists who really has deeply engaged with mainstream thinking. He understands it arguably better than anyone studying or teaching today. He's not only a talented mathematician, but he actually reads the underlying text, knows the history, engages with the models, and unpicks their flawed methodologies. I think it's quite telling that despite the many flaws that he's exposed, not just on energy and climate, but also as regards money and debt, the core reasons why most economists fail to foresee the last crash and are arguably failing to foresee the next one, you'd be hard-pressed to find critiques of Steve in the mainstream. And that's the point we're trying to make with this series, because they don't have to. They are the dominant thought school, but their flawed models have real-world consequences. A bit of a health warning. This interview gets slightly technical in places, with Steve discussing some of the maths both behind those mainstream models as well as the alternative economics that he is building. He even uses a software he's developed to explain his approach. If you do wish to engage with it, you will need to watch that over on YouTube at Invisible/Handcuffs. I'll also include links to Steve's Patreon site and his online courses and other resources that he mentions in the show notes. If this episode leaves you with more questions than answers, then do feel free to leave a comment on whichever platform you're viewing or listening to this on, or sign up and subscribe to us at invisiblehandcuffs.com, where you can also comment on every episode and receive new episodes and articles and other materials that we're producing straight to your inbox. With that, please join me in welcoming economist Steve Keen. Well, welcome, Steve. Thank you for joining us, and also happy belated birthday.
73. I wish I could reverse the digits. That'd be the one wish I have for my birthday.
But yeah, I know, I realize, and we were just talking offline there, I know this has been a very busy week for you. So thank you for taking the time to join. We've spoken a little bit about what we're doing, but maybe if I can start with a question. This is all about economics. What's, for our audience, can you tell me what kind of economist you are? How would you describe the economics that you
do? I literally introduced myself as an anti-economist. Because I'm so disgusted with the state of economics that I don't want to be identified with it, even though I'm a professor of economics. So the dominant strand of economics, in my opinion, should have been terminated at least 60 years ago, and preferably even 100 years ago, because anomalies kept on mounting up against it. And rather than the theory changing to cope with the anomalies, it basically ignored them, or it became even more distorted to work its way around that. And consequently, you have a paradigm which is extremely complicated and which fails to see major events in the economy and leaves out the major factors that make the economy change in the first instance. Sort of the two extremes, if you like, in terms of ideology amongst approaches to economics, because economics is characterized by lots of different, what they call schools of thought, which have totally different foundations and different objectives too. You've got Marxists at one end who think that capitalism is there to usher in socialism. You've got Austrians at the other end who think capitalism is already a utopia. Why would you want to change it? And then the neoclassicals are the dominant group, and they are similar to the Austrians, but they take a mathematical approach. That's about the only difference between Austrians and neoclassicals. And then my school of thought is called post-Keynesian. And I think that's an inappropriate label because it started with Keynes, but there were many, many other influences coming through. And it doesn't really tell you what we do. I'd call it realist economics, because the people who end up in this particular school are people who've been stuck in departments with radical Marxists and conservative Austrians. And for God's sake, let's just describe the system we're in. Let's get the description right first. So a level of pragmatism applies to the school of thought that I'm part of. And that's where I think the only real hope for economic theory is to expand a pragmatic approach, saying you describe how the economy operates and get the description right. And instead we get this ideological melange, and that's why economics is so both compelling but also so frustrating.
Yeah, and that's also part of the reason that we're doing this. You did engage, though, with what we call kind of neoclassical economics or mainstream economics today. How did you get started? And maybe if you can briefly, and I know you've probably told others this, but for our audience, briefly sort of describe what was your kind of moment where you just realized that this wasn't the right...
There was a moment. I remember where I was and what I was doing at the time. And that is that I'd done economics at school in the 1960s, 69 and 70. The concepts you were expected to understand were more complex, more advanced back at school in those days, and they tend to be at universities. And that's partly because the actual concepts themselves are false. But we learned things were how economists derive the idea of demand curves using what they call indifference curves, and how they derive what they call production functions using isoquants, all that stuff we did at school. And what it makes you into is a zealot for a market economy, because the theory ends up saying that you maximize social utility while minimizing the cost of producing the goods and services involved. So it's a welfare maximizing system subject to constraints. It's a meritocracy. So everybody gets paid their marginal product, which is their sort of individual contribution to production, and it reaches equilibrium. And that must be a good thing, eh? Isn't equilibrium an exciting place to be? So all these concepts make economists zealots for their vision. And then the way they approach it is they want to change the elements of the real world that aren't like the textbook. And that's the sort of thing that happens. So I remember, for example, I wrote a student essay, which has been lost, thank God, where I said it would be a great idea to abolish trade unions and abolish monopolies. Okay, that's the sort of mindset it gives you. Then in July, I think it was, of 1971, we had a new lecturer for the microeconomics course.
Can you just explain the difference between micro then and macro?
Well, micro is supposed to describe the behavior of individuals or firms, whereas macro is supposed to be about the emergent behavior of the entire system of the economy. So micro talks about marginal cost and marginal revenue and marginal utility, and then macro is supposed to be about aggregate demand, aggregate income, prices, inflation, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So the micro course, we had a new lecturer, Frank Stillwell, who's still a good friend, and he had, in doing his PhD, he started to break away from the theory. So he taught us some stuff in that first year course that you don't normally get taught. And what he taught us was what's called the theory of the second best. And this is actually a conventional economic theorem in one sense. One of the people got the Nobel Prize for the work they did, Lancaster and somebody else. And what that showed was that if you're using conventional economic theory, you took looking at the example he gave was the wage bargain. So the conventional theory says the best outcome for everybody is atomistic employers, as they used to call them. So no employer associations, no trade union. And then they get a competitive market for demand and supply, and that'll give you the best possible outcome. Workers get paid their marginal product, and you reach equilibrium. Okay. Now, what you could do with a conventional theory is show that there's a trade union. What would happen is that the wage would be higher and the level of employment would be lower. Okay. So that's why you're anti-trade union. Now, what Frank showed in that lecture was that when you include that there's a monopoly buyer of labor as well as a monopoly seller of labor, then you get two, the point of equilibrium isn't given by the equality of supply and demand as it is in the conventional theory. It's given by what are called a marginal revenue product and marginal social product curves. And it's actually indeterminate. There's a range of outcomes between workers getting a lot and capitalists getting a lot. If you abolish one or the other, you make the situation worse in terms of social welfare. Okay, so what it says, if you're two steps from the economic nirvana, then taking one step towards it makes things worse. And I remember just being in shock when that was said to me, because I thought, it's crazy, because the underlying theory says you're best to abolish trade unions and monopolies when you take into account the realistic the fact that there are both employer associations and trade unions. Abolish one or the other, you make things worse. So the only way you can make things better is to change everything that's different about the real world into the textbook simultaneously. Although this is crazy. So I checked my textbook. There was nothing about it in the textbook we were using. I went down to the library to read the original paper because at that stage I was studying mathematics, so the mathematics wasn't particularly a challenge for me. And I thought, it makes eminent sense. This is realistic. Why am I not being taught about it? And I started distrusting textbooks at that very point. And then I started looking through the journals and I found what was called the capital controversy debates. And this was also something I hadn't heard about. And that basically said that there was a theoretical conflict between Cambridge University in England and MIT in Cambridge, United States. This is called the Cambridge controversies for that reason. Yeah. And the people in UK were criticizing the theory and the people in MIT were defending it. And the paper I found was one by Paul Samuelson, who's probably the most important neoclassical economist in history in terms of his impact upon the discipline. And the paper was called A Summing Up, and he actually conceded defeat. Okay. Now, this I could cover the story as to why, but it was quite remarkable. The final line says, if all this makes people nostalgic for the old time parables of neoclassical thought, we must remind ourselves that scholars are not born to live an easy existence. We must appraise and respect the facts of life. And I thought, fantastic. Now let's read his textbook. So this is he wrote that paper in 1966. I think I had the 1970 version of the textbook. Not a mention. I think I'm being lied to. The theory that it gets the superficial stuff that people get taught in conventional economic textbooks is leaving out all these complexities which undermine the theory. So that's when I became a broke away, and I went from being a believer in neoclassical theory to an absolutely strident critic in about 2 weeks.
Oh, goodness. And Samuelson, I think, if I recall correctly, isn't the quote, I don't care who's who's the president of the United States, as long as I write the textbook, was attributed to
exactly.
Samuelson.
He wrote that in as a preface to a teacher's manual that accompanied his textbook. He said, because he mentioned a poet, then he says, some scholar, it may have been I, remarked that. I don't care who writes the laws, as long as I write the economics textbooks. And that's true. I mean, this is what we're seeing around the world. Virtually everyone who's in power, with the exception of Donald Trump, in a sense, has read and swallowed an economics textbook to some extent, and they accept the superficial, simplified stuff they learn in first year. And then they're advised by people who've done PhDs, and they think that they know the complexities. But the ones who do the PhDs are ones who never had the revelation that I had and just think the theory is all sound. So you end up with people in politics imposing neoclassical ideas as what they think is advanced economics, and they're supported by people who claim to be experts, but unlike me, they haven't been exposed to the rotten underbelly, and they end up defending the theory when they should be rejecting it.
Yeah, very much the thesis of this project as well. I think about 70%, I read somewhere, of decision makers will have done some kind of introductory course in economics. And like you say, it's not what I discovered as well. It's not that economics, you sort of start with a basic simplified picture and then sort of get a more realistic picture. What seems to happen is that you start with that basic picture and then you do more and more maths and specialize in a narrower way and never really gain that broader.
It's quite a complex process that goes on because I remember objecting to assumptions like perfect competition. My first year lectures, once I've become a rebel, so it's a simplifying assumption. Don't worry, you drop it in future levels. So keep on going and you'll get a more realistic theory. But the reality is all the attempts they made to prove various core propositions in the theory failed. I mean, it's all nonsense mathematics. Looks sophisticated, but they actually had an anomaly they couldn't solve, and they made a set of crazy assumptions to get over that, and that's what happened. So the assumptions you get in first year are mild compared to the garbage you're expected to assume in subsequent years. But once you've been conditioned to believe it's describing a perfect system, people become inured to the fact they're making crazy assumptions to get to this idea of perfection.
Yeah. I'd like to get into this a little bit more, especially how it impacts climate economics, which is where I first came across your work. I realize this is quite a technical conversation we're having, and I'm struggling with this myself and how we communicate this, how problematic this fixation on equilibrium is. I'd like to just backtrack to kind of the bit of the economy that economists, I think, miss most, which is the planet and energy. So can you help our listeners understand how economists think about energy or perhaps don't think about energy and what your contribution to this has been?
Yeah. I mean, they pay no attention to energy at all. And this is because they used to have some understanding back when they did what are called computable general equilibrium models. They've abandoned that now and they use what they call dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. And they go from having like 100 commodities to a single commodity through time. And they see equilibrium through time instead. Mm-hmm. That work means that they don't even imagine how production occurs, but their production system says you combine capital and labor in a factory with technology and you'll get output on the other side. Okay. Now, there's no inputs from the natural world in that assumption, and they don't see any problem with that. But when they do include energy, they say, well, maybe we should take a look at energy. So they tack energy on. They have capital as an input, labor as an input, and energy as an input. And they then there's a mathematical trick of raising the inputs to a power, like squaring or cubing or that sort of thing. But they do it in such a way that the exponent is equal to the share that industry has in national income. So when they just do labor and capital, they give labor a 0.7 coefficient and capital a 0.3. And what that says is that a 1% change in labor will cause a 0.7% change in output, and then a 1% change in capital will cause a 0.3% change in output. But when they include energy as well, they slice energy off from capital and say capital is now 0.25. energy is 0.5. So what that says is a 10% decrease in energy will reduce GDP by 0.5%. So energy is pretty unimportant, and they'll literally say that. I can find quotes where they say that. And production is quite insensitive to energy. Nothing could be further
than this. Coming back to what you're describing there is, I think what we learn in our first year economics, the Cobb-Douglas production function, right, where
production
you have
function,
capital
yep.
and you have labor, and these combine together, you mix them up and you get output. And that yep. capital, because I think that's important to understand this, which is a K I can remember from my equations, is what yeah. machinery was always for me a little bit unclear what that was supposed to mean. And you're saying it doesn't actually.
Oh, it's machinery. Yeah, it means machinery. But a farce that goes right back to Ricardo. It doesn't actually start with the neoclassicals. It starts with Ricardo. Okay. Is to trivialize capital and to confuse physical capital with monetary yeah. capital. Okay. Now, monetary capital, you know, I can use $100 and I can go, you know, buy a bicycle. Or I can use $100 and go for a trip to some other. You can use money for any purpose at all. It's fungible. Mm-hmm. They treat physical capital the same way. So you can move physical capital from one industry mm-hmm. to another without mm-hmm. loss. Now, that's nonsense. And that's one of the essential failings of neoclassical economics. You can't move capital from one industry to another. And even the way they define do you know Lionel Robbins' definition of economics?
Go on, give it to us.
Okay. It says that economics is the study of the process of satisfying ends, which basically unlimited ends, with scarce means, which have alternative uses.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what's the alternative use for a blast furnace? Can you make a cappuccino with it?
Okay. Yeah.
If you really want to be realistic about what we're doing, it's things which do not have alternative uses. And therefore, you can't reallocate capital from one industry to another. If you're going to change the weights of industries in your economy, you've got to invest more in one over time and less in the other. So it's not a question of allocation of resources, which is what neoclassicals teach their students it's all about. It's creating new resources and letting others degrade through investment and depreciation.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's there's a complete fantasy at the foundation of neoclassical economics, and because that fantasy fails, it can't support the weight put on top of it. Then there's just crazy assumption after crazy assumption to maintain a facade mm-hmm. of being scientific and well grounded, but it's all fantasy.
We have this kind of basic idea in neoclassical economics that the main inputs are capital and labor, and they're infinitely substitutable, and apparently you can move them around all the time. And there's not really any concept of time in that either, right? So from 1 month to the next, you could go from being a wine producer to a textile producer. But if we can come back to energy a little bit, because this is, so I got into your work. I first discovered you through your work on climate economics, which we'll get to. But then I started reading some of the other your other critiques of economics, and I came across your work on energy. So as you said there, energy is kind of, it's missing from this model, and it kind of gets mixed up in technology.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit, because this is something that I kind of was drilled into me at university, and then later when I was doing my work on the limits to growth, I noticed that a lot of the critics from economists was around the technology. The fact that what that model had apparently not done was take into account the fact that, you know, technological change and technology can basically be a substitute for, I think as Jay Forrester put it, you can basically use technology to overcome limits indefinitely, right? New innovations will come along. Whenever there's a constraint, innovation will come along and it will get rid of that constraint, and then we'll have growth. And am I right in thinking that the work you've done kind of shows this isn't true?
Yeah, I'll tell you, they leave energy out, okay. But if they do include energy, then they add it on as a third factor of production. So you have capital times labor times energy, where they're each raised to a power of an exponent that reflects the share they have in national income. Okay. Now, when you look at that, that means that they're predicting that like a 10% fall in energy would cause a 0.5% fall in GDP, 10% fall in labor would cause a 70% fall in GDP. So energy is fairly trivial. That's what they end up concluding. I never was satisfied with bringing energy as an extra factor of production, because what it implied was you could have a factory, put workers and machines inside, hit it with a lightning bolt, and goods will come out the other side. Just yes. didn't make sense. So I thought, how do you actually incorporate it? And the little insight that came to me that enabled me to do it was the little saying, labor without energy is a corpse. Capital without energy is a sculpture. So rather than energy being an additional factor of production, it's an input to both labor and capital in different forms, obviously, without which they can do no work. Now, when I do that, for example, I increase the exponent they use for energy in their model is 0.05 or 0.04 percentage of the energy makes up of GDP. When I put it through this thing, I got an exponent of 0.3. It dramatically increased the importance that way, but it's still wrong because it's still assuming that you can substitute capital for labor. And if you don't have enough capital, you can substitute labor. No, you can't. There are fixed technologies. And that's one, they trivialize the importance and they leave it out of their models almost all the time, including the ones working in climate change, so-called. So they're completely ignorant of the role of energy. And what it means is they put us into a false sense of security, because what they're telling us is that it doesn't matter if energy falls by 10%. You know, you can just, a few extra workers will make up for the loss of energy, and then there's no problem. Now, when you look at the data, it couldn't be more removed from that model. So the data shows there's a one-for-one link. If energy goes up, so does GDP, and by the same percentage. If energy goes down, so does GDP, and by the same percentage. Because a common phenomenon for me is that I wouldn't, when I plot the real data, I get something that I wouldn't dare make up if I was trying just to make my case to con students. So this is the level of energy measured in megatons of oil equivalent between 1970 and 2020. This is gross world product measured in 2015 American dollars. And they're both rising. You can see similar characteristics to them. So you get a huge correlation coefficient because they are going in the same direction. But when you look at the change in energy and the change in GDP, they're the same magnitude, and that's unusual. Yeah. So if you get a 6% increase in energy there, you get a 5% increase in energy. Down here with the COVID, you have like a 10% fall, get a 10% fall in GDP, 10% fall in energy usage. So they're absolutely lockstep with each other, and the correlation is crazy, 0.87. Now, according to neoclassicals, that should be 0.05.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. It is crazy. And I think, the reason I kind of wanted to get onto the technology bit is also on how it links to AI, which we know is an incredible consumer of energy. But just before that, can you explain the solo residual?
When the Cobb-Douglas production was first drafted by Cobb and Douglas in 1928, they fitted three time series that they had to the Cobb-Douglas function. And they had an index series for output, index series for capital, index series for labor. Okay. And so they still started at 100 and they rose to different numbers over time. And they claimed in that the correlation coefficient was extremely high, both for when they're both rising, but also when they're detrended. But they didn't detrend. They used a moving average, and that failed to actually remove the trend. The trend was still there. So the correlation coefficient they got was because they hadn't properly detrended the data. So the thing is, if they'd done their stats properly, they would never have published the paper. Okay. Now, but nonetheless, it became dominant amongst economists because it encapsulated what they thought about the distribution of income. They thought workers get their marginal product of labor, capitalists get the marginal product of capital, and that's your welfare maximizing, socially optimal outcome. So that's why they fell for it. And then Silo said, well, we've left out technology. We better bring technology in. And then what he did was he had an output series for income, an output series for labor, an output series, so series for labor, series for capital. But he didn't have anything for technology. So he said, oh, well, the technology is going to be the difference between the two. Now, it turned out that's what's called the solo residual. And the solo residual is about 70% of the change in output. Okay.
Yeah.
Completely trivializes the other two inputs. But
Sorry, just to clarify, so the solar residual is essentially that explained. Which can't be explained by the other two.
Yeah, yeah.
So if output increases, there's a portion of that is attributed to labor being whatever more productive, a portion of that is machinery that goes to capital, and then there's this other big unexplained change, and that's the solar residual.
Yeah, yeah. And they call it the measure of our ignorance, because they can never measure it. They derive it from other series. So they derive the solar residual as a gap between change in income versus change in capital and change in labor. And 70% or more of the result ends up in the residual. But it's a fallacy, because what Solo did in that paper, he said that because we don't have data on technology, I've got to derive it. And to derive it, I've got to assume that Cobb and Douglas got the exponents right. Okay. Right. So from that point on, nobody ever went back and checked whether they got the exponents right, because you just assume they're right and then everything turns up in the solar residual. Now, I have gone back and checked the data, and there was exponents are wrong. So it's another way in which the theory is, you know, it's a house of cards.
Wow. I didn't know that part. But what struck me with this, if I understand correctly, because what I found strange about this residual is that you already kind of had capital. If machinery is not
machinery embodies technology, exactly. Right. It's stupid to separate the two out, okay?
Yeah.
Because the way the technology is embodied, you have a new machine which can handle larger high levels of energy input, and the technology is actually built into the machinery. So we use K as how many machines there are. But what's happening over time is the capacity of those machines to process energy is rising. So the technology is actually embodied in that. There was no need for the solar residual.
My interpretation of Solo's residual was basically, if you assume that the technology is in the machinery, then what he's missing is that energy, which has been the main driver, right, of all the industrial production we've seen. It's allowed us to do, like you say, it's turned the corpse into a machine.
Yeah.
It's allowed us to do the technical innovation, but without the energy and the resources,
you can't do it. You can't produce anything.
You can't do it.
Yeah. And the other thing about the solar residual is that when you take my argument that labor without energy is a corpse, capital without energy is a sculpture, then you're not saying the inputs are labor and capital. The inputs are labor multiplied by the amount of energy that a worker consumes over a year, multiplied by the fraction of that that actually goes into production. And equally for machinery, it's the number of machines, however we measure that, multiplied by the energy consumption per machine per year, multiplied by the fraction of that that's turned into useful work. And so when you do that, you then find that the so-called solar residual, you can actually come out and say it's actually the contribution of energy to production. And then you rearrange it and you find you get the Cobb-Douglas production function at one end times the energy throughput of a representative machine of a particular time. And that's why you get that rising A. It's actually energy. Mm-hmm. They're not even aware of it, but that's what it is.
Yeah. And yet it's so ingrained in this idea that all we need to do, if we're struggling to get growth, what we need is innovation.
Yeah.
Right? And we can forget about, you know, the energy intensity of that innovation because it's not there, right? So we'll do whatever, we'll use AI. And on the labor side, I'll be talking to have a feminist economist that I want to bring in on this in particular, but also what we miss is all the work that goes into that labor as well, that person or the people that are going to the factories that are going to produce that work. To tie this up then with, you know, with this kind of very linear equilibrium way that economists kind of look at the world, and where I came across your work is because you had been talking about how we should have moved away from this, you know, this very linear view of the economy a long time ago. And you started talking about systems dynamics, which is what I discovered when I was doing my research into the limits to growth. So can you illustrate, you know, why something like a systems dynamics approach to understanding the economy would be more helpful?
Yeah. And the basic, I mean, if one way you can think about it is that there are two big E's that came out of the 19th century, equilibrium and evolution. Now, who in their right mind would look at a capitalist economy and see equilibrium? Okay? It's anything but. It's evolutionary change and dramatic evolutionary change over time. And instability of systems comes out of that. So evolutionary systems don't reach equilibrium. They continue changing. We're always far from equilibrium. So that's what we should have had. We should have it should be EV rather than EQ coming out of the 19th century. But economists who'd locked themselves into this way of thinking, they made equilibrium their alternative to evolution. And that's leaving out all the interesting stuff about capitalism that way. So that's a starting point. But system dynamics shows you the causal relationships between one factor and another. So when you put a system dynamics model together, what you're saying is this particular flow causes this stock, and then this stock causes other flows, and this stock causes other stocks to vary in importance, and so on and so forth. So you're drawing a causal, it isn't just a loop diagram, it's a causal loop diagram. So you're mm-hmm. actually saying what causes what. Now, what I've also worked out fairly recently is that you can get exactly the same results from system dynamics, that you can get that from taking macroeconomic definitions and turning them into dynamic statements.
Okay.
And then having simplifying assumptions to link together the different definitions. And you get the fundamental models of post-Keynesian economics.
Okay. Maybe if we just kind of then backtrack a little bit, because I know that you're working with systems mm-hmm. dynamics
yep.
now. You talked about what it is. What I found so interesting about the model, so when I first discovered the limits to growth and I looked at the World 3 model, it's like you say, you have an actually not very complicated, not a huge number of variables, but core elements of the economy, and they had resources and food and population yep. and health. And each were connected to each other. If one part of the system changes, other parts change. And also what you said there, I find really important, which to me seems to be missing, again, when I look at the neoclassical economics models, is this difference between stocks flows. Actually, Donella Meadows said that was a thing that economists don't understand. They think in flows, not stocks.
Yeah.
They think of GDP rising every quarter or every year, and they don't think about what land has been moved, what energy has been used to produce that, what problems might be building up. Are we improving the health of the population over time with this GDP? Are we potentially degrading long term? So, I don't know if you can talk a little bit more to the way that you're approaching this. And maybe we can also get in here to climate economics, which is where I think some of the worst example of
absolutely
this very linear
worst.
Thinking
yeah,
comes
absolutely
in.
Absolutely worst, yeah. It's like I've invented a software package called Revell. And it's one of many system dynamics programs. The unique feature it has is the capacity to model financial flows using what we call Godly tables. So that's an innovation. Mm-hmm. No other program has it. But the basic idea is showing things as a flow chart. So a very simple model. And I don't have energy in this, but I can explain energy comes out of the capital output ratio in this model. That's what the capital output ratio is, the inverse of the efficiency with which machines turn energy into useful work. So it does turn up there. So I have capital determining output, output determining employment, employment determining the rate of change of wages, wages times labor determining profit, profit determines investment, investment determines borrowing, because firms, when they want to invest more than they take back in repayments, they borrow money to do it. They've got to pay interest, which also gets deducted from profits. Investment, net investment then leads to increase in the capital stock. And if you simulate this model, then you get a process which is non-equilibrium. So this system will actually lead to a financial crisis as it happens, because there's a rising level of private debt, which is happening here. And that then leads to diminishing and then rising cycles, as you can see over here. And at some point, the place you'll get a crash, complete crash in the economy. So that's the sort of modeling that I do.
And what I think is interesting, and we'll show this, I don't know to what extent our viewers will be able to follow all, and I'm keen to look into it more myself. But what I find important in this kind of building up the economy based on the real world, looking at what is actually happening, what are the dynamic relationships between these different elements of the economy, and coming up, because those people that maybe have not put together, have not done econometrics, as I unfortunately had to go through as well, though, that kind of line that goes like
cycles.
This, up and down and up and down and up and down, that simulation, which is what you get out of the kind of models that you do, is also not really possible, if I understand correctly, in the kind of economic models that neoclassical economists work with, because they're typically working with historical data or data across space or time and pulling a trend from that. So you can't get those kinds of simulations of what might happen, because you can only work with this historical
that'd
analysis.
Be good. If that was a problem, that'd be good. Okay.
Is that okay?
The real problem with them is that they force equilibrium on the model. So as it happens, the equilibrium of their model is unstable. Okay. This is the typical thing. Every time they do anything trying to find equilibrium, they find they've got an unstable equilibrium. They made that vice into a virtue by using it as a way of explaining the trade cycle. But without shocks, their models just sit permanently in equilibrium. Just got a flat line.
Right.
Okay? If you get a flat line, you're dead. Okay. There's no dynamic system that does not have endogenous cycles. So when you're living
in endogenous, meaning cycles coming from inside, from
you don't
system.
Need to be shocked from the outside. So like our circadian rhythms change, our sleep rhythms change, all these things were changing all the time. And if you get a flat line at any point, well, you are dead. Okay. So the idea that equilibrium rules is basically saying death rules. No, it doesn't. Life rules. So life is cyclical, and then the cycles turn up easily in these models because you're not trying to force an equilibrium outcome in the first instance. And have you met Jorgen Randers and Dennis Meadows?
I've spoken with them.
Okay,
yes.
I've met Randers a few times. Haven't met Dennis, but I've met Randers a few times. I met him in Sydney University back in the early 2000s, and he said that when they came up with the model, they thought economists would really like it. System dynamics.
Yes.
Because it would free them.
This is the World 3 model. Sorry, I should also say for other, Jorgen Randers and Dennis Meadows members of the team that built the limits to growth model.
They thought that whatever economists might have thought of the limits to growth, he thought they'd be delighted to find they didn't have to assume equilibrium anymore. Instead, they got immense hostility. And of course, the person who led the hostile fight against them was William Nordhaus.
Yeah. Yeah, which is something that I discovered and which is actually what brought me to your work. And I think this for me is also fascinating. I've made this point as well when I've been asked about the work that we did on kind of uncovering the reaction to limits to growth, that for me as well, it felt like this was a new way of looking at the economy. Yeah. That the MIT were bringing through. They weren't necessarily ideologically driven in the sense that they cared about the world. Dennis and Daniela Meadows had just spent a year traveling through India. They had seen poverty. They'd seen environmental degradation. They were also seeing environmental degradation in the United States. And they did care about that. And they thought, okay, here's a new way of looking at the world, and kind of naively put it out there. And then we're subject to, you know, really quite awful and painful attacks. And Daniela wrote about it quite emotionally. And William Nordhaus, a famous climate economist, a godfather of climate economics, built the model that was used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, won the economic equivalent of a Nobel Prize in 2018, I believe. What I discovered from Nordhaus is that, yes, he'd been one of the economists that had most vehemently attacked the limits to growth, spent then about another two decades working on his alternative, which is an integrated assessment model in the lingo. Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered then getting into his work?
Absolutely trivial empirical assumptions made by Nordhaus. Like when I first decided to critique their work on climate change, it was after I'd worked out that role of energy in production. So I regret this now, but I thought at the time that I really can't dive into this area unless I've made a positive contribution to it. So once I did the energy logic, that was published in 2019, I think, with Bob Ayers and Russell Standish. And I thought, okay, now I can read them. And what I expected was I'd have to explain to the public why it's a bad idea to use a Ramsey growth model. This is the basis of all modern neoclassical models is a paper in 1928 by a mathematical prodigy called Frank Ramsey. And that was a model where he said, what is the optimal savings level for a country? So trying to work that out using neoclassical concepts. Now, that is incredibly complicated. And I thought, this is going to be hard. And then I read Richard Toll's 2009 paper, The Economic Effects of Climate Change. And I got to one paragraph, and again, I know where I was, it was literally right here. I was in shock. I thought, you bastards, you idiots, you're going to kill us all. Because the assumption they made was that they don't have data on what climate change is going to do to GDP over time. So they assumed they could use what temperature does to GDP across space and use exactly the same data for what's going to happen to GDP through time. And as soon as I saw that, I was in shock. So that's I realized I haven't even bothered explaining the technical side of Dice's model because it's the empirical assumptions they make that are crazy. And so even if the Ramsey growth model was a perfectly accurate description of capitalism, the numbers mm-hmm. they've made up for the impact of climate change have no bearing whatsoever on climate change. So, and they're trivial as well. So that was what just horrified me. And I thought, you know, somebody has to warn about these bastards. And as usual, it's me.
There's a quote from your latest book, which I'll put also into the notes on Patreon, Rebuilding Economics from the Top Down. Yeah. You write on talking about how neoclassical economists review other economists' work, that they read the method by which the results were derived from the assumptions rather than casting a critical eye over the assumptions themselves. So when I, again, even going back to when I was doing my first dissertation in economics and I was looking at comparative advantage, and I was trying to find papers that would help me sort of get to the core ideas and assumptions behind this theory, and I kept just coming across papers and papers and papers with very, very complicated maths, which I had not done very much in my bachelor's. I had sort of managed to get through my bachelor's in economics without doing too much maths. So it was frustrating because I couldn't interact with this. And I feel when you talk about the work that you've done on the climate economics, to me, when I read these papers, and Toll is probably the worst. I think he came up with, was it 10 degrees of warming would be acceptable?
Yeah, crazy numbers. Yeah.
For me, it's that the method works, and they'll put this analysis out there, this paper, which will then go to peer review, and it will say something like, these results are consistent to a confidence interval of whatever point, whatever. Yeah. And it will sound incredibly reasonable. But what has happened is the reviewer has looked at the math and thought, this is a good mathematical model. The numbers add up. And they've not looked at the assumptions, which, as you say, are nonsense. You can't use historical, or you can't use data
across space as data for data across time. That's what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. This is like looking at, you know, two different places in the world. How does GDP affect, how does the weather basically affect economic output?
Yeah.
Also often in a time where there hasn't really been a massive impact from climate change. And moreover, even if there were, and this also comes back to something that Daniela Meadows refused to use GDP in the World 3 model for limits to growth, because it's something that compounds lots of different things, including the damages that we might pay to clean up.
Yeah.
So you might have GDP rising in places that are being hit by climate change purely because they've had to build back. But the well-being and the long-term productive output of that economy could be massively damaged. The paper that Nordhaus wrote, as I understand it, I think it was Measurements Without Data.
And had the hide to say that there was no data behind the limits to growth.
Right, which I think gets to another, and again, it's a challenge to sort of explain how fundamentally problematic it is that the economists take this approach, because it comes back to this idea that economic, neoclassical economics is method, right? It's applying this particular method objectively to the world, which is often this form of regression analysis or time series analysis, you know, putting together past trends to sort of project into the future. And what the limits to growth was about was looking at relations and simulating potential futures based on these relations. So there was a lot of data there, but what I think seemed to get Nordhaus was that they hadn't used this particular method of, you know, historical
trends. What they'd done is they spent several years working with domain experts in each of the areas they included in the model. And they then produced a set of index numbers starting in 1900 going to 1970, which reproduced the model, and then they ran it forward. So there was enormous work to work out the relations between 1900 and 1970. That's empirical data. As usual, Nordhaus's claim is just bullshit. Completely false. I don't think he even knows that he's making fallacies, because he doesn't even know when he's making absurd interpretations of climate research. I think the guy has got a serious dose of what's called the Dr. Pangloss disease. Whatever he looks at, you know, the old joke about a child who's painfully optimistic, and the parents decide they've got to, you know, they can't let this kid just go through life expecting everything to work out well. They've got to wake him up. So they give him a present, which is a box full of horse shit. Okay? And he opens it up, and they expect him to be absolutely mortified because his Christmas present is full of horse shit. And he is happily digging through the horse shit. And they say, what's going on? I said, well, all this horse shit, there must be a pony in here somewhere. Now, that's the way that I look at Nordhaus, and that's how he seems to interpret anything he reads. He just reads it to see what he wants to see in it. So my favorite example is how he read Tim Lenton's work. And I met Tim through Nordhaus. Okay? So Tim Lenton is the main researcher leading efforts on tipping points. And there's a paper in 2009, which was a survey paper that Tim did with several other people, where they surveyed people on 9 major tipping points of the planet that they thought were going to be triggered in this next century. And the various likelihoods. And they finally, the conclusion says that society may be lulled into a false sense of security by smooth projections of damages from climate change. Our work shows that there are the several tipping points which should be triggered this century. The most dangerous are the Arctic summer sea ice and Greenland, but at least 7 of the other 9 could surprise us by having an early tipping point. Well, the way that Nordhaus read that, he said that this survey found that there were going to be no serious tipping points for 300 years until temperatures had risen by 3 degrees Celsius. Now, how the hell can you read that out of what was written in that conclusion? And my result is he doesn't read this stuff. He skims and looks for what he wants to see.
But he is writing papers. And these papers are being peer-reviewed and are getting into the public domain and then are used for decision-making. Yeah. And in fact, I think the DICE model, well, okay, with the Trump administration, I don't think the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is doing much anymore. But at least under Biden still, they were using the DICE as among their models to make decisions on things like carbon pricing, things like subsidies. So it's not just Nordhaus. I think this is why I thought this quote about, you know, the assumptions was so important. It's that it's only neoclassical economists reviewing other neoclassical economists' work. Yeah. And getting it through. And when critiques come from outside the discipline, they are not accorded any weight.
They don't accord criticism inside either. You had Pont Pindyk and De Canio and quite a few others having Stanton attacking them and saying you can't use a quadratic for the damages over climate change. And they just, the most recent paper that Nordhaus published, I think it was 2024 with Barrage, and he said, we reviewed the literature and a quadratic is quite well supported.
So, can you explain what you mean by
quadratic? Yeah, a quadratic is y equals x squared. So it's the simplest, like the linear equation y equals x. The simplest nonlinear equation is y equals x squared. And then the question is there's going to be a constant before that, a times x squared? How big is a? And so what he says is damages from climate change are going to be equal to a very small constant, that's the a, multiplied by the temperature change squared. So what he says is, for example, a 6-degree increase in temperature will reduce GDP in 2100 by, I think, about 7%. Okay. Now, that means that the constant he's using is like a 0.002, really, really, really tiny constant, claimed to have derived from empirical data, but it's data about weather versus GDP across the planet. It's not about climate change at all. So they're using a function which implies no sudden tipping points. Again, in the manual for the DICE in 2013, Nordhaus said the damage function is a quadratic and contains no tipping points, but this is consistent with the survey by Lenton. That's when I knew he had to be bullshitting, because there's no way a climate scientist would say this. So I went looking for the Lenton paper and found it. Then I got in touch with Tim and said, you know, has this got any justification? He said, absolutely not.
Maybe just to sort of also put this in context, the 7% or whether it's a 3% or 7% reduction in GDP by 2100 is other than it would have been
in 2100. Right? It's another mythical number. So it's really easy to convert it to a rate of growth prediction. But the normal thing economists are going to show with the prediction is what's the percentage rate of growth going to be next year. What Nordhaus started doing, and nobody has deviated from it in the group producing these garbage papers, but they say we're going to predict, we tell damages as a gap between two hypothetical numbers, GDP in 2100 without global warming and GDP in 2100 with global warming. Okay? They're both hypothetical; it hadn't happened yet. And the idea that you can have a figure for GDP without global warming is crazy, because the planet we're on that global warming is occurring. Okay? So it's a crazy combination. But when he first did his estimates, this is back in a paper in 1991, he said that 3 degrees of warming by 2100 would reduce GDP in 2100 by 0.25%. So like if you imagine, like let's say GDP today is 100 and GDP in 2100 is 1,000, so a factor of 10 increase in, which is the sort of rate of growth we actually experience, then he's saying rather than it being 1,000, it'll be 999.75, you know? So you end up with absolutely trivial predictions. So in that particular case, the damage to the rate of economic growth from 3 degrees of global warming was about 0.002%. And that we measure change in GDP, we measure to one decimal place. So this is two orders of magnitude below the level you can measure. And that's, he set that framing, and most of the neoclassicals that have followed him have been stuck inside the same framing. So rather than refereeing ensuring quality, referee ensures groupthink.
Yeah. That's one of the outcomes that we've identified as well in this work. And it's sad in a way, I think, because a lot of and I've interviewing and have interviewed some environmental economists and climate economists, so mainstream neoclassical, for this research, and very committed people, very keen to do good in the world.
Yeah, that's right. That's why they're so dangerous.
But they're entering in good faith and going into a topic thinking that they're getting the tools that are the leading cutting edge tools to do this work. And then we're coming out with outcomes like this. So there are a couple of things that I find particularly important in revealing kind of the flaws in this thinking with the Nordhaus model. One of them is there's no feedback on GDP over time to the climate, to the global warming that is taking place. This is what I find kind of stunning, is that if you use these models, which is based on this idea that there's some kind of optimal temperature increase, right? Because economics is also, back to the Lionel Robbins quote, you know, it's about the allocation of scarce resources, and there are these things as trade-offs. Yeah. So what we might spend our resources doing today to mitigate against climate change, that has a trade-off, right? Because we could maybe be doing more productive things with our time today. And in 10 or 20 years' time, when we have this amazing productive economy, we'll be much better placed to tackle climate change. So we'll do it then. So you end up with this putting off.
Exactly.
Whereas, again, what climate science would say is act early, and therefore you will mitigate the worst outcomes. Yeah. And also what a more stock flow kind of based look at the economy would tell you is also you build the infrastructure you need today. You don't wait until 30 years and you've not got, whether it's nuclear, whether it's solar, whether it's whatever capacity you need. So you end up with this opposite outcome. And so that for me is also this whole thinking has fed into the delay in action, right? Because this is coming out in 1990s, and it very much must have colored all of the climate negotiations as well.
Absolutely. And look, that's the one thing, your point you made about how sincere they are, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. They actually believe they're doing good. And I'm in my next book, which is, I hope to finish it by June. It's going to be a squeeze, but the title is How Economists Will Destroy Capitalism. And I start off by saying, don't overrate sincerity. Okay? The most sincere person you'll meet is somebody chasing you down the high road with an axe trying to cut your head off. And so the most dangerous people on the planet are people who sincerely believe something which is false. Normally you think about religious fanatics being in that situation, but it's actually economists are the most dangerous ones.
One other point about the neoclassical model, and I'm conscious as well a bit of the time here, so to be able to talk as well about what you're trying to do, including books and the other things that you're working on. But a final link for me, I think it was your work also that introduced me to alternative theories around money. Uh-huh. And I don't know if there's a link here. I personally also think that there is a link, though, in these kind of cost-benefit analysis that climate economists are doing, because there's this idea, right, that money is scarce. Yes. It's a scarce resource. Yeah. And therefore, we have to use it most productively. So can you tell me how do economists or neoclassical economists get money wrong?
They treat money as a commodity, okay?
Yeah.
And you can always run out of a commodity. And also everybody can save a commodity simultaneously. In the real world, money is a relationship. The bank has a deposit account with you, or you have a deposit account with the bank. That's a liability the bank is required to honor. If you ask for your money back out, they've got to give it to you. So these liabilities and assets give mutual obligations. And you can create mutual obligations quite easily. You just simply agree to taking on debt that creates money. So they're completely wrong about the money creation process. Their models just don't make sense. They're false according to accounting when you check them out with my accounting software. So they're completely false models. But they argue you've got to conserve this thing, which is money. No, you've got to use this thing, which is money. And so by conserving, we haven't created enough money in that sense for infrastructure. And then what their theories in terms of global warming are doing is saying, oh, don't worry about it. Leave it for later. So I think economists, I really do blame them, Nordhaus in particular, of course, but all the cabal around him as well, for delaying action on climate change because they completely misunderstand what it is. And so they're telling us that, you know, like 7 degrees of warming. If you see the survey by Howard and Sylvan of neoclassical economists working on climate change, okay, so they asked this, you know, 2,000 of them, 380 answer this particular question of what's going to be the impact of a trajectory towards 7 degrees of warming 2 centuries hence. And the median prediction they gave was a 20% fall in GDP in 2200, and the average was 25%. So they're saying 7 degrees of warming will affect the rate of growth of GDP by just slightly more than the accuracy with which we measure change in GDP today. So it's trivializing the whole thing. You read climate scientists, my favorite paper there is Zuman Ramanathan from 2017, and they say 1.5 degrees of warming is dangerous. So they say that's elaborate. They say 1.5 is dangerous, 3 is catastrophic, and 5 is existential. Yeah. Now they're saying 5 degrees, we probably won't exist as a species. And here are the economists saying 7 degrees will reduce the rate of economic growth by 0.14% per annum.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting as well is how this consensus and climate consensus has remained pretty stable over time. I mean, I read the first IPCC report recently because I wanted to compare Nordhaus's 4 degrees of warming with the first IPCC report. And it was basically 1 degree of warming, roughly, by the end of the century is where what we should aim for. And his outcome was 4 degrees and not really understanding the difference. But just coming back to money, because I do see this as a really central assumption, and I'm getting the sense actually more and more that this lies at the heart of one of our problems today. This idea that money is scarce, you got to save it, and in particular, what we learn in the neoclassical mainstream economics textbooks still today is this idea that, in particular, public spending, so public money, if the public sector is spending, then that's taking away spending that the private sector could potentially put to more productive use. And I think that this assumption is also built into these climate models, right, about we shouldn't spend too much unproductively, whether that's, you know, putting in cycle lanes or whatever, because, hey, we might do something more productive over here with AI, and in 20 years we'll be able to pay for fusion and we won't have this climate problem. So what is a better way to think about money?
Well, money is a promise, okay? Money's the bank promises you'll let you take your money out of the account whenever you want it. When you buy something off somebody, you transfer some of your money to their account. That's transferring the bank's promise from you to them. That's what's actually going on. And there's the private sector creates money, and so does the government. So the private sector creates money by lending out more than it gets back in repayments, and the government creates money by spending more than it gets back in taxation. So the government should be running a deficit because that's how it creates fiat-backed money. And instead, with this lot, because they abhor deficits, they treat the government as like a household. And so if a household spends more than it earns, it's going to go bankrupt, guaranteed. But they say, well, the same thing applies to the government. No, it doesn't, because the government actually creates the liabilities. The rest of us use as money. And in fact, one way that a government marks its territory is where its currency is accepted for commerce, and its currency is a liability of the government. So governments expand their region, their range, by expanding where their liabilities are accepted for commerce. And in that case, you want the government to be creating fiat-backed money. So it's a complete perversion. Their models are just completely irrelevant and elaborate. Well, they look elaborate, They're simplistic, yeah. really. But that ends up telling us we've got to, you know, we can't afford to spend on education, health, and welfare because we might run a deficit. We can afford the bombs, of course. So this ludicrous attitude means you undercut the social welfare side of the government. You stop producing the infrastructure. You don't get the pure scientific research done. It's actually by trying to save money, they're destroying our capacity to create productive resources over time, including those which could actually address climate change.
Yeah. And this is something that Keynes understood, right? So coming back to the fact that you did describe yourself as a post-Keynesian.
Keynes's book was called The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Okay. Now, he didn't handle money all that well, frankly, in that book.
Okay.
But he saw the importance of money, and he said what money is, it's the amount of money we wish to hold is a measure of how much we distrust our own expectations about the future. So he had a real idea about expectations and money being and expectations which are wrong because you can't know the future. So this was a large part of Keynes's argument. Now, the neoclassicals couldn't understand Keynes. John Hicks reinterpreted Keynes using supply and demand diagrams, and that became the basis of what was called Keynesian economics in the 1950s and 60s. But it was a complete distortion of Keynes, and Hicks himself finally admitted in 1981-82 that his model, that he called the model of Keynes, wasn't actually a model of Keynes. It was a general equilibrium model he invented 2 years before he read any of Keynes's papers. So the whole argument about it is wrong, which is one reason I invented Revell. So what I've got here is a four-sector view of the economy. You've got the banks, households and firms, the central bank and the treasury. And this software is designed to show that what is an asset for one person is a liability for somebody else. So if I have debt as an asset of the banks, for example, then that is a liability of the household sector. Okay.
Yeah.
And then if you have deposits, which are a liability of the banks, that's an asset of the household sector. Okay. And then if you want to show how bank lending does, then bank lending involves banks putting, say, loans, dollars per year, into your deposit accounts, okay? And they also put loans, dollars per year into your debt. You can't get the money without agreeing to get into debt. And so that's the way that that is created. That's using the debit and credit approach that accountants use.
Okay.
And now I'm going to add in the government sector. So this shows private banks will create money if loans are positive in that model. Okay. So that's creation of money that way. But the way the government does it, what it does with taxation is it takes money out of your deposit account. So you get minus tax coming out of here. And of course, when you pay tax, you know, it reduces the amount of money in your account. You don't get any other compensation for it. So it's actually reducing your net worth. So I'm just going to have this as the private sector net worth there. And so that's going to reduce your net worth minus tax. Okay. Now the question is, how does that get to the banks? It's now turned up here. Well, there's also assets that are called reserves, which are the bank account of the private banks at the central bank, and the central bank also has an account there, which is the treasury's. That's that's a liability of the central bank and an asset of the treasury. And now, if I'll just actually have the central bank net worth here, and the bank's net worth up here and the treasury down here. So the tax reduces deposits. It also reduces reserves. So we get a minus tax here. And that's because it gets transferred to the treasury over here. So what you find is taxation increases the net worth of the government. Okay. Now, nobody objects to that because we all know that taking tax out of your account reduces your net worth and increases the government's. Let's now add spending. So if I have government spending here, then that's actually the basic reverse of the process. So you're going to spend from this account. So there's going to be a minus spend here. That puts the government's net worth down. The spending gets transferred to the reserve accounts. Okay, that turns up over here, and that's credited to people's deposit accounts. And that means that government spending increases the net worth of the non-bank sector. Now, that's the exact opposite of what you read in textbook economics. It tells you that if the government runs a deficit, it takes money away from the private sector. That is 100% wrong. It actually creates deposits for the household sector. So this is what you need to do to understand money properly. And that's why I invented this software, because I was so sick of the myths that people were making using supply and demand curves to try to understand the banking system.
Yep. Thank you, Steve. We'll definitely include this. And this sort of brings me into what you're doing there. But just to wrap up on this, there are two things about money. One is that this different understanding of government money, and also not just that government spending is putting money into the private sector, but it's a different quality of spending. It's usually spending into things that then support the productive economy, whether it's helping people be healthier so that they can go to work, whether it's roads, whether it's cycle lanes, whether it's this kind of infrastructure, whereas the private sector, who decides where the private sector creates money, and it is creating money as lending. Yeah. I think the latest data that I saw from Positive Money, if you follow them, a think tank based in the UK, that 90% of credit creation right now is going to the non-productive economy, mostly mortgages and other kinds of lending for assets, so the financial sector. Can you talk a little bit about, because you're one of the things that you've been famous for is predicting the financial crisis.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that the private banking sector makes money by creating debt in the first instance.
Yeah.
So they want to suck us into as much debt as possible. And businesses will put a limit on how much debt they'll take on because they're making profitability decisions all the time. Households don't take on too much credit card debt because they know it's a high interest rate, and they have to service it over time. But we'll borrow to buy a house because we expect the house price to rise. And that leads to an amplifying feedback between change in credit and level of house prices. And that's what ends up, the banks end up financing Ponzi schemes. They cause house prices to rise. We borrow money from them to do it. We pay them interest in the process and generate a huge amount of debt, which just makes houses more expensive. It doesn't actually create more houses. Yeah. So the price of houses in terms of all other goods has risen by a factor of five since 1970. Yeah. And that's all because of banks lending too much money to buy houses.
Yeah. And where they can get the most return. I was shocked by this data as well, because I was calculating it as well. And if you compare that then to wage growth, I think wage growth or income growth has sort of doubled or just over. So you have this massive then wedge between cost of housing and income. And if you then add in women coming into the workforce over this time, it basically wipes out all the gains of women entering the workforce. And so we've been sold this great emancipation story. We end up actually worse off, working more, doing the care work at home, doing the unpaid work, and then also doing the other work. And we've had this massive increase in asset prices. So maybe we can get on now then to what you're trying to do, because then the question is, so what conclusions do we draw from these critiques? And you're not just criticizing the neoclassical economics, you are trying to build this new economics. You've shown me the Ravel software that you're working with, but maybe you can talk a little bit more about your goals there. Right.
Yeah, well, the whole thing is that neoclassical economics has to go. It's as bad for the understanding the economy as Ptolemaic astronomy was for understanding the universe. In fact, Ptolemaic astronomy is probably superior to neoclassical economics because at least gets the location of the planets roughly right. But it's completely false. And when you use a false theory as your guide to running the system, the theory just supposedly describes, you screw the system up. So we've had an enormous inequality, reduction in the level of productivity of our economy, undermining manufacturing, promoting services and speculation and gambling on asset prices. The world people are born into the day is a very, very speculative and personal gain-oriented system, which only works for those who've got money in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it ends up being a massive source of inequality. Less innovation, people are more stressed. It's an awful situation, but we're locked into it because we believe in supply and demand curves. So I'm saying you can't just criticize them, you've got to have a complete alternative theory. So I've worked out how to do that. So like the micro level, for example, they teach students that marginal cost rises. No, it doesn't. Empirically, it's constant or falling. So you need enough the theory for how firms make a profit. And I've done the mathematics on that. It's extremely simple. And it basically shows that products are differentiated. They're not uniform. A homogeneous production is another stupid assumption, completely false. But with differentiated products, firms have constant or falling marginal cost. And therefore, if you're successful in getting a larger level of sales, you'll reduce your per unit cost and increase your profitability, which gives you an evolutionary advantage over the other firms in your sector. So there's an evolutionary non-equilibrium theory of the firm that comes out of it. You get a class-based theory of income distribution. Social classes were something the neoclassicals wanted to get away from because that was part of the classical school that Marx used. You need a system with social classes, income distribution driven by power and bargaining capability, money flows, energy being vital, and non-equilibrium behavior being the hallmark of the system. And that's what I've been, I think I've actually managed to get virtually everything finished except the theory of trade. And that's what I hope to finish writing at the end of this year. I'm mainly teaching online these days. So there's, if you see there's a webcast, stevekeen.com. Pardon the over-the-top marketing. Okay, it's very heavy-handed. But I then teach three courses in that. I teach an introductory course with 9 lectures. Then I have a long course, which has got over 60 lectures. It's like an entire, it'll turn to about 100 lecture course at some point. It's basically an entire sort of master's level education in non-orthodox economics. And then I have a seminar, a live seminar I run every week as well. And I do them twice, once for the Western Hemisphere and once for the Eastern Hemisphere. So that's the main way people can find me. It does cost money to get in there, but, you know, you get realistic economics, and there's actually a great bunch of people that I'm teaching in that class. I really enjoy the crowd that's turned up there. So that's what the main teaching I'm doing. I'm also teaching into a small course at the University of Amsterdam, but mainly what
Can I ask, or can you share, you know, what sort of people are coming and what sort of numbers are you getting, but also maybe what...
So over 1,000 people have signed up so far.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. But, and it's a lot of fun. I thoroughly enjoy the people. Mm. They're getting their own research projects inside. It's some marvelous work they're doing.
Great. Well, that was actually going to be my question is, you know, what are people doing with this? What's your hope, and what are these are saying that they're going to work on afterwards?
Well, some people, one of my successors, a guy called Tyrone Keynes, of all things, has built my models to the stage where he's tied everything I made as a parameter, he's made into a variable. And he gets extremely sophisticated models of the economy and endogenous cycles coming out of them. So he's off on that tack and doing brilliantly. And then inside the group, people have developed an AI that can create models.
Okay.
So you say, what do you want to build? And it'll then build the model for you. Another group producing a syllabus that they think would work for a lay audience effectively. I can't keep up with the number of projects they've started internally.
It's incredible. It's a lot more innovative than your average economics course. Well, no, I'd love to maybe catch up at a later date about that, because I do feel like a lot more people need to get this kind of grounded, real-world understanding of economics.
Yeah.
And I really do appreciate everything that you're doing. Maybe just a final question. Do you have feedback for us? Do you think, is it worth, you said that you've given up on universities? I guess part of me still hopes that maybe we can get some universities to change.
No, the neoclassicals dominate universities, and they dominate the refereeing system. They dominate research grants. There's just no chance of getting decent stuff at a university. When you do, like I did at Kingston and also at Western Sydney, there'll be some government policy driven by neoclassical economics, which destroys your financial viability. So the reason I left Western Sydney was because the government in Australia deregulated first-year student intake and the belief they should be left to the market. Okay? We used to get 120. As soon as that change was made, we got 16. And that department was shut down. So there goes my program. Then I got to England, the Kingston University. And what does the UK government do? They also deregulate first-year student intakes. Mm-hmm. So they took longer for that to destroy the humanities program at Kingston and the other, or they call them post-92, I think they call it post-92 universities, but it destroyed their student numbers. So we can't get a decent toehold. The only universities which are going to teach non-neoclassical economics are going to be regional universities where, you know, if you're living in Leeds, where you go to Leeds University. Well, Leeds is pretty good, and so is University of West England at Bristol, and you get some decent stuff at Greenwich as well. But mainly speaking, you're going to get a neoclassical course no matter what. So my advice to people really is say, study something else. If you're interested in economics, come and learn from people like me offline. Yeah. Mm. Don't bother. At university, you're going to get brainwashed by mainstream economics thinking. Don't bother with it. Do another degree.
Thank you very much, Steve. Really appreciate this. And yeah, thank you for everything that you're doing.
You've been listening to Invisible Handcuffs, Unchaining Economics, hosted by me, Katie Shields, with music, art and production by Philip Melchers. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider liking and following us on YouTube or your favourite podcasting platform, and by subscribing on our website at invisiblehandcuffs.com, where you can also find the show notes to this episode and more about the project. With that, thank you for listening, and I hope to see you next time.